Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So some say it was the greatest time trial in the history of modern cycling or even old school cycling. And Jonas Vingegaard, who put a massive 1 minute 38 into Tadej Pogacar on the time trial stage of the Tour de France. And today we are going to be analyzing that and plenty more in this episode of The Science of Sports.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So welcome, as usual, to Professor Ross Tucker, who is all the way talking to us all the way from Boulder in Colorado. He's been there on a bit of a conference and been watching the Tour de France and all the other special sporting events that have been happening over the last couple of weeks. And what a week and what a weeks it's been over the last couple of weeks to talk about the science of sports. We're going to get stuck into our main subject of the day, which was the amazing time trial by Jonas Vingegaard, or as Ross has correctly said, Jonas Vingegaard, which is in fact his correct spelling. I was not sure that Ross had that right, so I went onto YouTube. I looked up the correct pronunciation, as Jonas would indeed say it himself, and it is Jonas Vingegaard. So that is the correct pronunciation if you're doing it the right way. But if you listen to the many commentators,
we do have a Danish friend. Yes. He's not Danish speaking, but he's got Danish family. So given that Vingegaard has been around for a few years now, we might have figured this out sooner, but we get there eventually.
Exactly. But let's kick off with a couple of other highlights. And we don't want to, there's so much to talk about cycling because for us and I, it's something that is a real passion of ours. But if you weren't watching the cycling on Sunday, you were probably watching the Wimbledon final with Alcaraz and Djokovic. And of course, Carlos Alcaraz, the winner of that event. And it was a fantastic final, of course, five sets. The win for Alcaraz, the 20-year-old, and some of the interesting stats around that. And if you look at the tail of the tape, which is kind of a good assessment of where they both were, and I think this is one of the key points in tennis, which is probably the most crucial point, is it's not about how many points you win, it's the right points that you win. And the total points won is that Alcaraz won 168 and Djokovic won 166 in that five-setter. So it just goes to show you how close it was. And there are many different stories on the internet, which you can look up and see some of the stats that are up there, but for both of them, it's an incredible amount of similarity between the two of them. The only thing that stood out is that Alcaraz had more double faults, literally more than double the double faults that Djokovic did, but also had more aces than Djokovic, 9-3. So again, Ross, it was a great final, and potentially a handing over the torch from the older generation to the new generation now.
I hope so.
Well, you don't know.
Did you? I missed it there. Did you say winners and unforced errors?
So winners and unforced errors. So total winners was 66 to Alcaraz and 32 for Djokovic. So that was a big change. And then on the unforced errors, 45 to Alcaraz and 40 to Djokovic. So, you know, Alcaraz was certainly the one going for more winners and was the more aggressive player. But in every other respect, they were pretty much equal.
Yeah, so if you make twice as many winners and almost the same number of unforced errors, then you know who the quality player on the day was, right? But then, but then again, Djokovic was winning matches by forcing errors, not looking for unforced errors. So that would be the other one. And I've often wondered that, actually, is does someone sit there and go, that was an unforced error? Mm. And how accurately? If you showed 100 assessors the same 50 points, wonder how much agreement there'd be between a forced error and an unforced error. Winners is obvious, but the others I've always wondered about. But anyway, that's an aside. You know, we spoke about Alcaraz in the French Open when he basically couldn't make it through three sets against Djokovic.
Yeah, I had that cramping problem. Yeah.
And just the I didn't even think he'd make Wimbledon. To be honest, I thought he'd be out of it with an injury, because I think the biggest threat to him is injuries. You know, he's already missed this year's Australian Open. I think he missed a couple of tournaments ahead of last year's US Open, which he then won. So he clearly doesn't need to play three or four tournaments before a major to win him, which is something, if I was his team, I'd be paying very close attention to, because I would be saying, here's how many tournaments I would play ideally, and then I'd be cutting it in half just to try and extend his career. Because that really feels like the only threat to him. And interestingly, I think the length of the points on grass being as short as they are and maybe a more forgiving surface, it probably becomes one of the surfaces he does the best on.
Mm. And yes, he grew up on the clay courts, really. That was his background. But he seems to have adapted, and you say, maybe even more suited to the hard court, grass court sort of forms.
The hard courts are the ones that I reckon will hurt him the most, because you can't slide, you know? And so it would be interesting to see how many hard court tournaments he gets pulled into. Like, now, obviously, they go across to North America now and they play those Masters Series events. Will he stay healthy for that? I hope he does, because he's, you know, like every one of the big three had something about them. He just seems like he's like a sawn-off shotgun in a world of water pistols. You know what I mean? It's just
that's a great description.
So I hope he stays healthy. And he also seems to be, imagine 20 years old, what were you doing? I wasn't coming back from one set down against Novak Djokovic at Wimbledon. So he's obviously very sensible, and he's got good teams and so forth. So then I guess the next question is, there's a batch of guys behind him, Ruud, Sinner, Holger Rune, who he beats at Wimbledon. Do any of them bridge the gap to him? Because if they don't, I could see him winning 3 out of 4 Grand Slams for the next 6 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is it fair to say that at 20, he is probably not fully developed?
Yes, definitely.
Physically.
And so that's both a risk and an opportunity, because if they manage the next 2 or 3 years and they develop him to the point where he becomes very strong and robust, then many of those injury problems go away. But, and this is like a cliche in the world of injury, is the biggest predictor of injury is a previous injury.
Yeah.
Because once you get an injury, you have two things happen. Is one is you develop compensatory patterns that then predispose you to a different kind of injury. So now you had a left knee problem that ends up becoming a right hamstring flare-up because you're favoring it and adjusting and so on. Or number two is you don't ever fully recover and you just start getting the same pattern repeating over and over. So a young guy who gets a lot of injuries, you have to be very careful with. But if they get it right, then as an older guy, you should see fewer injuries. So it's that seems at this point to be his biggest threat more than any opponent.
And I guess at the level, we talk about people like Federer and Djokovic and Nadal, you know, those kind of guys, the secret to their success has probably been the fact that they've been able to maintain a high standard and avoided injury for many years. Nadal probably less than anybody else.
Not Nadal. That's the big problem. Nadal, I wonder how many Grand Slams Nadal cost himself because of injuries, or was cost. I mean, it's not like he got injured on purpose. But.
And how many shots of cortisone he's had in that dodgy Achilles of his, which has been well documented.
You talk about now, you see, then you get a pattern, and now you're just going from one Grand Slam tournament to the next, trying to like paper over the pattern, but it's never going away.
Exactly. Interesting to watch. Another interesting news item, of course, very close to our hearts here at the Science of Sport, because Ross was very involved in this case a couple of years ago. Caster Semenya winning her case at the European Court of Human Rights last week. And of course, the big discussion is, what does this actually mean? So she won the case. Does it mean that suddenly the rules that World Athletics have now imposed on testosterone rules are going to be suddenly relinquished? Where are we with this?
Well, no, the short answer is no. The long answer also might be no, but there's detail to it. And it was interesting, like obviously here in South Africa, especially, it got reported with pretty big inaccuracies, but in a lot of other places as well. I saw headlines from The Guardian, The Associated Press and Reuters, all reporting that the court had ruled on the policy, and they don't. And it actually got legally complex to the point that, because as listeners may know, I was involved back in 2019 as an expert witness at the Semenya hearing at the Court of Arbitration. That was in February 2019. Mm-hmm. When that decision was announced, in World Athletics' favor, and it effectively meant that Semenya would have to lower testosterone. Straight away, there was talk of appeal. Mm. And along with the other experts who testified, we were all told, thanks very much, but you won't be involved in the appeals anymore. Well, why not? And the answer is that once you start appealing the CAS decision, it no longer becomes about the actual merits of the case. It becomes about the process by which the case was heard. And it leaves the normal sort of court system. I'm sounding like a non-legal person, which is accurate. And it goes into the Swiss federal system. And so the first appeal was heard by the Swiss tribunal, and then it gets escalated because that was rejected. And eventually it lands up at the Human Rights Court. But they are not assessing the evidential arguments of the case. Obviously, they have to read through all the documents that were prepared, so all those expert summaries and statements and so forth. But their key question is not whether the policy was fair and accurate and or discriminatory in an unjust, disproportionate way. They're asking the question, did Semenya have the appropriate opportunities with which to challenge that policy? And their conclusion was not. And to summarize it very basically, their end conclusion is that the Swiss system had been sloppy in how it handled Semenya's appeal process. Mm. So when that decision came out, World Athletics straight away came out with what I think was a very predictable statement, saying that this decision in no way causes us to have to reassess our policy. We believe the policy is fit for purpose, that it is proportionate, justified, and necessary, and we will carry on as we were. Mm. What it might do is it might give impetus and embolden someone to go back to the courts and challenge the policy, because they've now got a momentum on the human rights side of the argument. Because you'd all know by now, I'm sure, that the fundamental issue here is a fairness in sport issue versus a human rights issue of someone to not necessarily identify as they choose, but to identify as they were identified at birth, because that's what we're dealing with here. This is not a trans woman who changes and says, I'm now a woman, even though they are biologically male. This is a person who, yes, is biologically male, but was raised and identified as a girl at birth because of what, let's be honest, was a mistake at birth. Yeah. And so there's this tension between that right and the rights of other, well, of female athletes, not other female athletes, to have a sport that excludes biological males. And it's not inconceivable now that one of the handful of athletes will say, you know, we're going to go back and we're going to challenge this, because now we've seen that we've got a human rights argument that has been supported at the highest level, and we're going to go and win this case again. So that might now be imminent.
So, I mean, for us to say that Semenya is likely to compete at next year's Paris Olympics is probably highly unlikely, because that process could take literally years from now, I'd imagine.
It could well do. And I mean, the first thing is, as I understand it, is that there's an opportunity for the Swiss system to appeal this decision. And if they do that, then that takes a long time. In parallel, though, an athlete could well go, because remember what happened was in March, World Athletics, in conjunction with its trans policy, announced an update on its DSD policy. Remember that? And yeah. So the DSD policy today, as of the 19th of July.
And just to clarify, DSD is exactly what Caster Semenya is. And it's what difference of sex development, clarity.
So, yeah, and this is actually important. So let me just for a moment park what I was about to say and say this is Caster Semenya is biologically male because she has XY chromosomes, functioning testes, male levels of testosterone that can work in her body to cause exactly the same biological development as they do in you or I. And that's the problem. And that's what the media isn't yet reporting. The media still reports this thing like it's 2015 and it's a female with high testosterone. It's actually not. It's a male with typical testosterone. But because of these differences of sex development, something, and it's in athletic sports terms, it's one of two things. Something, quote unquote, goes wrong in the process. And so what happens is, in Semenya's case, that testosterone can't be converted to another hormone. And as a consequence, her external genitalia don't develop in the male pattern. And so you get these atypical, sometimes female typical genitalia. And that's why at birth, the doctor says, congratulations, it's a girl. Or in her case, probably not even a doctor because of where she would have been born. So that's where it gets really tricky. And you feel And I know you feel the same, like enormous sympathy, because in these cases, it's often sport that reveals to them that there's an issue. And they get to the age of 18, 19, and then someone in sport comes and says, hang on, I know you've been raised as a girl, but actually I've got news for you. And it's not, and it hasn't been handled well by sports. There's no doubt that the sports have made mistakes on this, but what it fundamentally comes down to is male advantage in women's sport. So back to the point, is they changed the policy in March this year, and it's now applied to all events, and the testosterone level is lower than it used to be. Because what they've said is you can compete in women's sport if you lower your testosterone levels. It's possible someone tries to challenge that. And if they did, they would have a pretty good case to say that this is an emergency because of the imminent Paris Olympics. And when that happens, the court does accommodate it. And so it's not impossible that within the next 3 or 4 months, a case is opened, heard early next year, and the athlete can then run in Paris if they win that case. I think that the world athletic position now is much stronger than it was in 2019, because they've had more cases, they've had Olympic medals, they've had Diamond League winners, all with these conditions, so they can point to case studies that they didn't have before, in addition to Semenya. And also remember that they had that like bizarre paradox where the old policy only applied to like from 400 to the mile. That's gone now. So I think theoretically, in principle, they are in a stronger position than they were. It'd be very difficult to win that case now, I think.
Yeah. As you said all along on this podcast, is that is nobody that's right. It's just one of those tragic scenarios where it's tragic on both sides. And we feel for Caster Semenya's case in this situation as well. So, yeah.
Yeah,
you we'll keep an eye on it.
It's the same thing with the trans thing, which we'll segue to, I guess, in a moment. But it's just a choice. And on one side, you've got all the scientific evidence. And on the other side, you've got this human rights, socio-ethical issue. But I would say that the other side also has that, because women have a right to fair and safe sports also. So in the end, the science, I think, becomes decisive. And you just have to pick. And I do worry, and I wrote an article for the patrons exclusively, in which I said that, you know, if this case was the catalyst to go back to the courts and challenge this and change the policy so that biological males are allowed into women's sport, I think it would be a great loss for women's sport, be a victory for one person and a loss for many.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've just created the segue I was looking for, and that is, of course, the decision by the UCI, the international body that looks after cycling, where they've made a decision which I guess in many ways is a logical one, banning transgender athletes from women's sports, which is, I think, a step in the right direction in many ways, isn't it? Despite all the controversy around this subject over the last probably year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, and it took them long enough to get there. This was a conversation they'd been having for a few years. It took them longer to figure this out than it took us to get Vinegar's pronunciation right. Because, like, you know, 4 years ago already, world rugby was the first Olympic sport. Powerlifting had done it before that. World athletics, world swimming or aquatics had done it early, like last year, so almost 15 months ago. And cycling kind of just dragged its heels and it dragged its heels. And meanwhile, cycling was the one sport, and I'm not sure why this is, but it was seeing more of these cases coming through than any other sport. We had Emily Bridges was the first one, Austin Killips, going back even further, like Veronica Ivey / Rachel McKinnon. I'm not sure what she goes by these days, but they had all these cases that basically proved the hypothesis is that male advantage outlasts testosterone. And so if you allow biological males into women's sport, you're going to see improvements in rankings because they're bringing across an element of performance that is unavailable to females. And sure enough, it was happening more and more and more. And then it started happening in better and caliber athletes. And you had there was that Tour of the Glia, I think, in the US, won by a trans woman. There were gravel races that were being won by trans women. And I think the unhappiness among the female cycling community grew to the point that they raised a voice that could no longer be ignored. So in the end, as much as it's logical and scientific, the UCI didn't change the policy because of some new science. That same science has existed for 4 years. It's more that they finally recognized the science because they were told by their own constituents that you are actually being harmful to women's sport by not acting on this.
Yeah. It's interesting that the UCI have renamed the section now because they've obviously said that they're not allowing trans athletes to compete in the women's event, but they've now renamed the men's category as Men Open. So it's now a category of men and opens. It's everybody everybody outside the women's category, essentially.
And that's what we wanted to do. When World Rugby concluded its consultation process in 2020, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to rename name women's sport, women's rugby, and we wanted the other one to be open and say that was the one that anyone was into. But the women's category would be closed with very solid borders. And the only entry into women's rugby was biologically female at birth. None of this assigned female at birth, as though you get sort of randomly assigned to one group or the next. You're a boy, you're a girl. Like biologically female at birth, and then open was for every single other person. And that was widely rejected because it was deemed to be stigmatizing and discriminatory and so on. So, but I think a number of sports have recognized that is the way to go. Like, start with the premise that you've got women's sport for a reason. That reason is biological. Draw boundaries around it, and then everyone else can compete elsewhere. And so, again, the media always report this in a way that's slightly frustrating, where they produce a headline saying, UCI bans trans women. No, at least you should be saying trans women from women's competition. But what you should really be saying is UCI decides to regulate women's category in cycling. That's what it is.
Exactly. That's how you got to reframe it. And I think people miss that point. It's about the protection of the sport for women rather than anything else. And that's kind of what UCI said. They said quite clearly that the evidence now suggests that there is too much male advantage, and they could change their mind. They even say that we could change our mind at some point if new evidence comes to light. But at the moment, based on current science, which is what we are basing the discussions that we have, the answer is obvious, really.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the papers, and in the interest of disclosure, there remains no study where an elite trans woman group, not one or two, because there are now some case studies, but where a biological male suppresses testosterone, having already been an elite athlete and then enters into women's, that hasn't been done as a study. What we have seen is Laurel Hubbard go from being a mediocre male weightlifter to an Olympic women's weightlifter at the age of 40 something in a sport dominated by people in their 20s. Not plausible. What we have seen is Leah Thomas, who was ranked in the 500s or I think 65th in one event, transition and then instantly become the number one swimmer in the US and win an NCAA title. What we have seen is cyclists like Killips go from being relatively mediocre, still very good, but suddenly being dominant. The other day, we saw a 49-year-old Italian Paralympic sprinter win a bronze medal in the Paralympic World Champs at the age of 49 as a trans woman. I mean, you're 50 years old competing against 22-year-olds, and you want to tell me that some element of your bronze medal doesn't come down to retained male advantage? So I think that there are now lots of case studies that bear out this biological advantage, but there are good longitudinal studies that show that the male biology that makes the performance, things like muscle mass, muscle strength, lean mass, fat mass, those don't disappear or become female. You can't change sex. It outlasts testosterone. Yeah. And so all that evidence is there. It's just that they finally decided to follow it. And I mean, it's numbers now, right? Because rugby, and then nothing for a while. Rugby league did it because those sports have a safety issue. Boxing did it. But then when you had World Aquatics go with a policy, World Athletics go with a policy, now cycling, surely triathlon. I mean, how can you have the elements of triathlon individually have a policy and triathlon doesn't?
Yeah.
So in other words, you have each discipline in your sport has a policy, but as long as you do all three one after the next, you can compete in the triathlon. So triathlon has to surely follow next.
Yeah.
And every time they do it, the language is the same, because the language is right. Women's sport is necessary. women's sport must exclude male biological advantage. There is no evidence that this can be achieved. Therefore, women's sport remains closed. Done.
Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, well, that pretty much wraps it up. Anyway, so let's move on to our subject of the day. So for those of you watching the Tour de France, stage 16, the time trial on a Tuesday, which was really just being pitched as the battle between Jonas Vingegaard and our famous Tadej Pogacar. And for those of you that watched, you'll know that Vingegaard managed to eke out 1 minute and 38, a massive lead over Tadej Pogacar. And the story that I think most encapsulated what we all thought was an interview that the famous world time trial champion Tom Dumoulin, the Dutch rider, he was quoted on Cycling News as saying, and I'll just read this a little bit to you, "We witnessed the best time trial ever in cycling. First of all, because of the lead that Vingegaard takes over the rest, but I also watched his ascent and his flat parts, and that was real time trial porn. It was fantastic to see. He took a lot of time uphill. His power must have been incredibly high, but also his descents and his cornering were just sublime." And that comes from a man, obviously, knows cycling pretty well, and of course, was a former teammate of Vingegaard. And I mean, Ross, just looking at that performance, the amount of memes and graphs that we've been sent over the last couple of days since that performance, there's obviously suspicion. There's that uncomfortable feeling where you look and you go, well, these guys are pretty close for the first 2 weeks of the tour. Suddenly Vingegaard is able to not eke out, but absolutely drill Pogacar, who is really, you know, at the top of his game at the moment. And suddenly the Tour of France seemingly is over in many respects.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, as we speak about this, the stage is on the go, and today's stage is actually the one everyone had identified as being Vingegaard's best chance to win this Tour de France. As it turns out, history might record yesterday. But yesterday, I mean, it was seismic, because everything in this tour for 15 days showed these two guys locked together. And yes, mm-hmm. there was a bit of separation on the Marie Blanc, then Pogacar got it back the day after that. So there were a few seconds here, a few seconds there. But we were talking like 0.05% difference between these two guys. Yesterday was 5% was the margin of victory.
And it was between Vingegaard and Pogacar. That percentage? Wow.
Yeah. And it was 8.7% from Vingegaard to Wout van Aert, who we know, and people are making a big deal of this. I'm not sure that a time trial that includes two climbs like that is exactly ideal for him. Mm-hmm. Yes, good, but still, I would have been surprised if he'd beaten either of them.
Mm.
But it's the margin of that victory that, you know, and people who've watched cycling for 20 years, they understand what this stuff, I was going to say means, but it's not means, that what it suggests. And so, of course, socials blew up. And here we sit again in the same situation of watching something that is so spectacularly impressive that it's uncomfortable. Mm. If he'd won it by 20 seconds, he'd have said, what a great ride. Like, you know, they were 10 seconds apart over 15 stages. He's now put 20 seconds. That's a big day. But he didn't win it by 20 seconds. He won it by a minute 38. And you and I, we were messaging with Troy and saying, like, this, okay, that time split's got to be wrong at 4K. Can't be 30 seconds.
Yes.
Okay, maybe it is right because now they've just confirmed it. Is he going crazy? Like, he's going to blow. This is going to be a serious pacing strategy failure. But no, because next time point, it was even bigger. And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And even on the final climb, he was even faster per kilometer there than he'd been on the first part. It was just, I mean, I saw people in the sport posting emojis of their heads exploding. That's,
yeah.
And what does that mean in cycling?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought was that we know that cycling for the last decade has been doing x-rays of bikes because of accusations of mechanical doping in the past, and everything from magnetic devices to little motors in the downtube. And my first thought when I looked at this thought, well, I hope they're going to x-ray his bike, because it felt like he was almost being assisted by some sort of device. It just looks so different. But when we look at the, let's just take the two of them as opposed to the rest of the field. We've seen lots of little memes and apps and diagrams of people showing the difference between the average Tour de France finisher. So the average speed, according to some of the memes I saw, was around about 35, 36 kilometers an hour. Vingegaard was 41, I think it was, his average speed, and Pogacar was 39. Does that look the same in terms of how much better they are than the rest of the field based on what we have seen in the first 2 weeks of the tour?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because now we dive into this thing and we say, okay, there's one, your first reaction to this. Well, my first reaction to this is like, wow, this is unbelievable. I'm almost a little bit uncomfortable watching this. But then you've got to start thinking a little bit about what is it exactly you're seeing. And the truth is that over the first 15 days, Vingegaard and Pogacar were cumulatively inseparable. As I mentioned, Vingegaard had his day on the Marie Blanc, Pogacar had his day the day after. But cumulatively, the only difference we'd seen between them was a 30-second sprint ability that Pogacar had to open a gap and then get held. And I think it was noticeable he would win the time bonuses, yes, and add 3 seconds plus the bonus. But when he attacked on the Zooplan with 3K to go, he got a 5-6 second lead, and then he got held, and eventually drawn back. And that sort of showed that these two guys are pretty locked together. They are, for any effort longer than about 30 seconds, they are very, very similar. But what is as clear is that they were way, way, way better than anyone else in this race. I mean, on that day, stage 15, just before the rest day, Pogacar attacked with 950 meters to go. And Rodriguez was on their wheel at the time. Vingegaard stayed with Pogacar. It took them 1 minute 50. It took him 2 minutes 28. So within a kilometer, they put 38 seconds onto the guy who's coming third in the Tour de France. That's how big the gap is between second and third. Similarly, on the Puy de Dôme, they were locked together with 1.5K to go. Pogacar attacks, 1 minute gained on the chase pack within 1.5Ks. So that's, again, that's 40 seconds per kilometer. So, and I know that doesn't translate exactly to a time trial performance, but the point I'm making is that the difference between those two and everyone else was so big that if they hadn't won this time trial by big margins, it would have had to have been a really, really bad day for both of them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like you know, there always used to be, and it was used in the doping contest, they used to say a race of two speeds, deux vitesses, right? This is a race of two speeds, because those two guys are just so superior to everyone third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. Imagine, just as an aside, imagine one of them wasn't here, how boring this Tour de France would be.
Yes, it's
the most boring Tour de France in 30 years, because it's 9 minutes. The gap is 9 minutes between first and third. Unbelievable. But anyway, I digress a bit. The point I was trying to make is that going into that time trial, with the exception maybe of Van Aert, had he saved his legs a little bit, nobody was getting close to those guys. So that provides a little bit of context, I think, in terms of the gulf between them. And I actually think, and I made this point on some patron podcasts, we did a rest day podcast for our patrons. That's one other reason to sign up on Patreon, by the way, folks. You get some exclusive pods. The gap between these two and everyone else was already, for me, a real cause of discomfort.
Yesterday
made obvious the gap between one and two, but over the course of the Tour de France, the gap between the top two and everyone else was already it already begged some questions, in my opinion. And yesterday we saw a race of two speeds become a race of three speeds. And the biggest problem now, in my mind, and it alludes to the Tom Dumoulin quote, is we don't know if that gap yesterday was Pogacar being 2% off and Vingegaard being 2% better. And that's 4 of your 5% right there. So was exceptional day for Vingegaard, or was that a slightly below par day for Pogacar?
So that was my next question. Yeah. If you look at Pogačar's year, obviously he broke his wrist earlier this year. And are we able to look at the performances at the moment and say he's not as good as he was previously on the tour?
For me, Pogačar is better than he's ever been at the Tour de France, because they did the Col Marie Blanc the other day a minute faster than he'd done it in 2020 when he won that stage. Mm. They were faster on the Tourmalet than in the 1990s. They were going faster on the Zuplan, which was a Pantani record, and we all know how that was achieved, until eventually, tactically, they slowed down in the last 2 or 3 kilometers of that climb. Mm. They broke the records everywhere else. Obviously, Puy de Dôme, not comparable because it was last written like in the 80s, so can set that one aside. But every major climb in this Tour de France, Vingegaard and Pogačar have been faster than the previous records. I find it very difficult to believe that Pogačar anyone can claim that he's coming here underprepared and not at his best form. If this is not his best form, then I mean, that's also a scary prospect.
Because it's better than it was before, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. What's interesting is that the two of them are slightly different, obviously, in stature. And I remember just talking a little bit about this in our podcast we did for the patron members. And my pick for the day, actually, the time trial was Pogačar, not to Vingegaard, which I've obviously had to eat my words a bit there. But physically, you look at a guy like Pogačar, he's reportedly weighing about 66, 67 kilograms. Vingegaard, the human skeleton, is weighing about 60 kilograms. Does being lighter on a course where there are bigger climbs and even when there are faster sections, I would have thought that the power of Pogačar would have been superior to Vingegaard over a time trial distance, and that even the uphill sections would have almost mitigated that. And I'm fascinated to understand a little bit about, first of all, how do you measure the speed and the power, and how does the physiology of the person actually make a difference? In other words, if Pogačar is doing X amount of watts per kilo and Vingegaard is doing the same watts per kilo, are they then dead even, for instance?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and you can dive into this thing in as much detail as you wish. So like let's try and make it practical. The first question you ask is what matters more? Is it the power output or is it the relative power output? So is it the absolute, the fact that I can produce 450 watts, or is it the fact that those 450 watts are being produced by my 60 kilogram frame, in which case I'm at 7.5 watts per kilogram, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer is that it depends a little bit on the circumstances. And so when you are riding on a flat road and you don't have to carry your mass up against gravity, absolute power appears to be more important, which is why when you watch the Olympic Games, those track guys, think about Philippe Ganna, for instance. I saw a photograph the other day of Philippe Ganna training with an Ineos teammate. And honestly, it looked like an adult and a child because of the stature and the size difference between them. He is so much bigger than everyone else. Even in this Tour de France, Mathieu van der Poel is a comparatively big guy. And so Paris-Roubaix, which is a flat race, absolute power is winning that race. Does that make sense?
Yes.
The moment the road starts to go up, the power to weight starts to count for more. And eventually, and it stands to reason, is that you can be 85, 90 kilograms. There's a limit to how much power your muscles can produce. So that 85, 90 kilogram guy, he's not producing 7 watts a kilo for anything more than a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And so the moment we hit an Alpe d'Huez or a Zuplan, Col de Tourmalet, et cetera, those big guys are going off the back. And you see that that's why you've got your Rolliers, your Jumbo-Visma, and even UAE. You've got Trentin and Mikkel Berg for Jumbo-Visma. You've got Thijs Benoot and Dylan van Baarle and those guys. And they do the work in the valleys. When it goes up, now it's Sepp Kuss's turn. It's Adam Yates's turn. So the importance of power shifts depending a little bit on the terrain. So that's first point. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Where it is surprising, and I remember one of the, and this takes us back to the sort of culture of suspicion in cycling. Time trials always used to be dominated by the big guys because they had the absolute power, and they didn't used to typically be a lot of hills. Sometimes you get rolling. That's why Indurain won 5 tours, because he was good enough to not lose time in the mountains, and then he would destroy people on time trials. And then there was a point, and I remember Contador beating Cancellara. Remember when, and I can't remember if it was 2009 or 6, I think it was about then.
Cancellara,
yes. Everyone said, like, hang on, How's this guy in the low 60s beating Cancelaro, who's like a time trial champion? That just something's not right, because that shouldn't physiologically happen. So where are these small guys getting that much power that they can now start? And that, in fact, last night, one of the more astute tweets I saw was like, times in the past that the Tour de France outcomes have made us feel uncomfortable. And that was listed as one of them. There have been a few in the past. Lance Armstrong winning in Sestriere would have been another one. For me, Chris Froome on Mont Ventoux was like, oof, what am I seeing here? I don't know how to make sense of this. So anyway, I'm waffling a little bit. The point is that in the mountains, it's the smaller guys who have the higher watts per kilogram. And on the flatter roads and the descents and the valleys, it's the bigger guys. Mm. And so, look, 6 kilograms between Vingegaard and Pogacar is not the same as Contador versus Cancellara. But you're right. It's Vingegaard is producing remarkable absolute power to be able to put time into, let's forget Pogacar, put time into Wout van Aert on that flat section yesterday.
Yeah, and that's where he was as fast as anybody, if not faster, on a course which, you know, those flat parts, the big powerful guys should have been the ones potentially putting time into him. You can understand him being good on the climbs, even though he kept riding his time trial bike versus Pogacar riding his climbing bike, he still put time into Pogacar. So yes. is that how you, when you look at those numbers, so you're saying that those numbers are relative to, so Pogacar's pushing out, I mean, there are times when I've seen some of the stats that it was almost 7 watts a kilo at some point for Vingegaard going up some of the climbs. I've seen some of the stats. I don't know how accurate they are, but are you saying that Pogacar, for him to get to those sort of numbers, he would have to be pushing out enormous watts just to be able to stay with him because of that weight difference?
Well, Vingegaard would be pushing out. Pogacar, because he's heavier.
He's slightly heavier, yeah.
Yeah, so let's say, for simplicity's sake, Vingegaard at 60 kilos, producing 6 watts a kilo, 360. For Pogacar to produce 6 watts a kilo, he needs 336, 340 watts. So yeah, he's got to produce 10 watts, 10% more watts, because he's got 10% more mass to carry. So that's how it works. And in that range of masses, that happens. That's not impossible. That's why Pantani and Armstrong could climb together, because Armstrong was able to produce the same proportional relative watts that Pantani would have been able to produce. And just on that, Nielsen Paulus posted his Strava file with power numbers. And you might know, listeners, that he was trying to win the King of the Mountain points. And so he, I wouldn't say soft pedaled the first 15, 20K, but he definitely took it easy until the 16th kilometer. And then he tried to go really hard on the climb. And on that 2.7 kilometer section that they gave the points, he produced 6.6 watts a kilo, and he was 10% slower than Vingegaard. So that puts Vingegaard at least at 7.3 for those 13 minutes that he did that climb. So that's the floor. When you add in the fact that he's going a little bit faster, so there's a little bit more aerodynamic drag. I've seen estimates at about 7.4 to 7.6 watts a kilo for 13 minutes. And remember,
doesn't seem possible, though. I mean, I've never heard those numbers.
Well, that's why people's heads were exploding on Twitter, and the emojis were doing the rounds. It's astonishing. And the physiology that you would have to produce that is remarkable. And on that, yesterday's article started coming out. People started tweeting saying that Vingegaard at the age of 17 was assessed in a Danish lab and had a VO2 max of 97. Which is like outrageously high. It would be easily in the top five ever measured. Now they're claiming that as a 17-year-old. I've never seen that validated and verified. So naturally I'm suspicious. I'm saying, well, where was it done? How was it done? Are we confident in the accuracy of that measurement? And I've actually just been looking at Twitter now, and a few people are doing the rounds again. And you know, there's a physiologist saying, as a Danish physiologist, I'm also yet to see evidence supporting this. It's astonishingly high. But if it is legitimately that high, you know, and you have a VO2 max of 97, then, you know, 7.2 watts a kilo for 13 minutes is not like outrageously impossible, because your physiology supports it. But is that physiology the case? I don't know.
That puts them literally in the freak zone in many ways, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, those people don't come along very often if those numbers are right.
No, but I think we can safely say there are two in the peloton at the moment. because again, like all the focus now for obvious reasons is on Vingegaard, but what we saw yesterday wouldn't happen again. Pogacar's as good as Vingegaard.
Yeah.
So whatever we're asking, I would just want to make this point, is whatever we're asking of Vingegaard, got to ask of Pogacar, because this is a guy who's also done remarkable things, like winning Flanders in the same season as potentially winning the Tour de France. Okay, and it looks like he might fall one step short of that second goal. But that physiology is also astonishing, because to win Flanders, you have to have the ability to produce these 30-second to 2-minute efforts in a 7-hour, 6-hour race. To win the Tour de France, a completely different physiology. And so you don't see that in a person very often. In fact, you don't anymore in the modern era. So both of them are producing performances that ask these questions. And I don't know, and just back to the Tom Dumoulin quote, is it the best time trial we've ever seen? We're speculating because we don't know the numbers.
Within the context of it, I mean, taking my cynic's hat off, and it's very hard to remove that hat because it's kind of stuck to my head in this situation. But what he talks about Dumoulin is the way that he, and those of you that watch the coverage, the way that he was taking the corners, the way that he was doing the flats, there was some sublime cornering skills. Just watching that was quite incredible to watch, which, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean he's, you know, pushing unheard numbers. He's just getting the tactics right. He's getting the cornering right. Like everything worked well for him. If we remove that cynic's hat, how do we explain logically why Vingegaard was that much better than Pogacar on the day? If you were able to hypothesize, how can we explain that?
Well, the one argument we sort of covered already is that these two guys were clearly at like a maybe never seen before level at the Tour de France, which in and of itself sets up some suspicion, but that we know that they're at an incredibly high level. If Vingegaard is 1 or 2% better than we've seen in the first 15 days and Pogacar is 1 or 2% worse, that's your difference in yesterday's stage, purely as a result of day-to-day variation. Okay, it's large day-to-day variation, but it could be that in the same way that what happened on the Marie Blanc and then what was reversed the very next day can be attributed to day-to-day variation, an exceptional day versus a slightly below average day. And if those two things coincide, that's a gap, and it's potentially a large gap. The other thing is that the other possibility, and you alluded to this, when we were watching this thing yesterday, we could see in the first 400 meters that Vingegaard was spicy and Pogacar looked controlled, right? It was visible. And subsequently, I've seen it doing the rounds on Twitter. Listeners may have as well. GCN did it, where they created a split screen of those two guys in the start. And in the first corner, Vingegaard gets a second more than Pogacar because he hits it harder, takes a different line, and he accelerates out of it. And if you looked at road markings and you timed it, he gains a second. Second corner, another second. Third corner, another second. So he's probably 4 or 5 seconds ahead within the first few hundred meters, purely because of aggressive and technical execution. Subsequently, they showed on some of the descents, Vingegaard takes the corner, different line, like absolutely perfect racing line, is pedaling before he's out of the corner. Pogacar, 2 seconds, then starts pedaling. Now, part of the reason, and you know this, is if you've just done a climb and you go over the climb, the reason you don't pedal is because your legs are cooked.
Yeah.
So you have to have really good legs to pedal quickly. But the point is that some of the difference that was created yesterday would appear to have been created because of technical execution on the bicycle. And I don't know what magnitude of advantage that is. It would make, I think, a fascinating analysis to literally go 200 meters by 200 meters and ask what the time gap was. And was that time gap created in a period of no pedaling or max pedaling? You know what I mean? Like
yeah, fascinating.
It could well be that 28 seconds of that margin were created while he wasn't turning the pedals.
Yeah.
Okay. So, there were 98 seconds. We've now accounted hypothetically for 28 of them. The bike change, I don't know. The fact that so few people did it suggests to me that it wasn't necessary and probably not optimal. So that's maybe a few seconds, but it's not more than 10, not more than 10. The other thing is that in a time trial at those speeds, particularly in the middle part of yesterday's time trial, is that if you can change your coefficient of drag and your surface area, you gain a lot. So you'll often hear them talk about something called CDA. So that's coefficient of drag multiplied by your frontal surface area. That's why they get into that narrow tuck position. That's why you have equipment like the aerodynamic cockpits on even on the road bikes these days, as you know, the wheels, the deep rims, and so on. I've heard it said that if you can drop that by 0.1, which is not insignificant, but still, that would be worth 15 to 20 seconds. Sitting upright on the bike, as opposed to being in that crouch position, is worth a couple of seconds over a few hundred meters.
And so, and to some extent, that was also evident on the climb, because even the commentators pointed out that Pogacar on that final climb seemed to be sitting more upright and not in an aero position, whereas Vingegaard actually, even though he was on the climb, was in the almost in the time trial bars at a super aggressive position. So it was arguably aero even on the climb more than Pogacar was.
Yeah, absolutely. And there've been some studies where they take guys into controlled environments in velodromes indoors so that you can get rid of the wind effect. And for example, you can ride at exactly the same power outputs and your speed will be, so I'll read to you here. They had a bunch of guys ride at the same power output, 250 watts. And they had them riding in a normal aerodynamic position as opposed to with the hands on the sort of bullhorns of a time trial bike. And the speed difference goes from 41.5 Ks in the aero position to 38.6. So that's a drop of 3 on 38. So that's near enough 7-8% slower when you're not in that aerodynamic position. And that's at slower speeds. The effect would be even larger at 50-60 K an hour. So again, if you cumulatively added up a dozen, 30 times in a stage where that happened, you could probably find another handful of seconds, maybe a few more, as a consequence of your, again, it comes down to technical ability.
Don't tell me you're talking about marginal gains here, are you?
Well, these are more than marginal. But the thing is, these things are known
Dave
by...
Dave Brailsford would be very happy with you.
Brailsford, yeah exactly. So anyway, the point is that that 1 minute 38 seconds yesterday need not be entirely the result of physiological differences between them. It could be a combination of equipment, technical ability, attitude, which I use as a word, hopefully you understand my meaning, is one of the guys was just more aggressive. And that's in part physiological, because you can't be aggressive if you don't have good legs. And if you didn't have good legs, you'd be more passive. So it could be that. But I still make the point that on the final climb, the final 6.6 Ks, he was like 7 seconds a K faster than everyone else in that ride. So whilst there was definitely a technical and a skill and maybe an equipment component to that ride, we saw at the end of the day, he just had physiology that was so much better than everyone else on that day.
Mm. I mean, going back to Dumoulin's interview, he even quotes the fact that both Van Aert and Vingegaard's bikes were made with were not painted, so they saved 150 grams. I don't really understand that, because I thought all bikes pretty much had a weight limit. So you could probably, it's because, I mean, essentially those bikes, and we're guessing it to some extent, they probably weigh virtually the same. Even the fact that they might not be painting their bikes, all those bikes, they normally add weight onto them just to get them up to the weight limit.
It was widely discussed yesterday that the Colnago TT bike was about 2 kilograms heavier than its road bike. And that was the reason that they made the decision to change Pogacar at the bottom of the climb, was because they saw that 2 kilogram weight handicap as being worth making a change. Whereas, as I understood it from what I've read, the Cervelo TT bike is light enough that there would not have been an advantage. And the climb was also fast enough that the aero benefit on the TT bike was going to be better than the weight benefit of the road bike. But it does sound anyway as though the Colnago TT bike is not ideal in terms of its weight, which you don't care about on a flat time trial, but you do care about on one like yesterday. So again, that's a handicap. And I've heard some people say that's why TTs are unfair, because they basically come down as it's a tech arms race, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas everything else is at least a race against humans. But You can, it doesn't matter how you dress it up, he still put a minute on everyone else in the last 6.6 kilometers. It was just astonishing.
Absolutely. So, one of the interesting things that I did notice, there was a footage of Mikael Berg, the UAE rider who does so much in the front of the bunch, particularly for Pogačar. And I noticed when he was in his time trial position, and it's kind of a bit of a segue, not a sidebar to the story here, but he was really twitching across the road, like massively. And it reminded me of a little bit of a comment that Chris Froome made when he had his big crash in the Dauphiné many years ago that caused basically the end of his career. He blamed the fact that time trial bikes are just really dangerous machines now. And that tight position, the arms close together. And looking at Berg when he was riding that bike, it did feel like he was really, really unsteady. And if something goes wrong at that speed, it can be quite nasty. So there's been some voices from the sidelines saying that, you know, potentially a time trial bike should be banned because they're actually too dangerous. And as you just commented, maybe they are giving an unfair advantage because it comes down to tech rather than rider.
I think they definitely do split even the elite field into the haves and the have-nots, you know. I don't know. UAE and Jumbo are obviously the two, along with Ineos, would be the best funded teams and the ones most capable of maximizing that tech. Remember when Ganna broke the hour record, he rode that Pinarello that had been 3D printed and was worth something in the mid six figures dollars. So, and I mean, this maybe breaks that record on the same bike as the predecessor, whoever held it before him did, but he's going to break it by a lot more thanks to tech than he would have otherwise. So it does come down to that. And I mean, now we're in that whole philosophical debate about tech versus performance. And I think the 1 hour record, fine, make it a tech arms race. But for it to be decisive in a tour, maybe I can see the point that those people make. I think when they put hills on these time trials, it does to some extent level that. And when they make them only 22 Ks long, as opposed to the 50, 60K time trials they used to have, then, I mean, imagine over 50, 60Ks if you're three to 5 seconds faster than your opponents, but you have a 4 minute time gap.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. Anyway,
lots could happen. I suppose it's hypothetical and in that situation because the pacing will be different. Pogačar could recover, all sorts of things that could happen in a long time trial. But yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and different physiology to ride for an hour as opposed to 34 minutes. You know, it's
100%.
You're moving quite far along that power duration curve. So that would make a difference as well. But back to yesterday. I suspect that Pogačar was slightly worse than he's been for the duration of the tour so far. Only reason I say that is because in the last sort of 6.5K, he was not better than his rivals by the same margins we've seen them better than them before. Even the day that Pogačar got dropped on the Marie Blanc by Vingegaard, remember that stage 5 or 6? It feels like years ago now. Even while he was in the process of being dropped, he was still gaining time on everyone else. Yates, Rodriguez, other Yates behind him, Gaudu, Hindley. Yesterday, he was faster than them, but not by a great deal. And so that suggests to me that he'd gone back to the field at exactly the same time that Vingegaard got better. So then you say, all right, are we looking at a similar situation to what we saw in 2020 when he was the victor and Roglic was the one who seemed to be going backwards. And again, I don't know, maybe Pogačar was producing better watts yesterday than he was on that climb on the Plateau de Bay in 2020.
Yeah.
And
the reason I'm
bleeding on about this is because not for the first time, so many of these issues could be held and discussed with much more context information if we just got the freaking power numbers. But like, are you still heading to Budapest in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, in a couple of weeks I'll be at the World Champs in Athletics in Budapest. We'll be getting some live coverage from that, so it's going to be interesting to watch.
Okay, so here's a hypothetical scenario. You're watching the men's semi-finals of the 400, okay, and you know who the guys are. It's Steven Gardner, it's Wade van Niekerk, and it's all these guys. And Wade van Niekerk fails to qualify for the final because he runs 44.96 seconds. You would be able to write a report saying van Niekerk failed because he underperformed, because his performance of 44.9 was 0.7 seconds slower than he'd run all season so far this year. So you'd have a very precise measurement that allowed you to explain, and then you explain why he underperformed. And conversely, if some unknown guy makes the final running 43.8, you say, this guy hadn't broken 45 all year. Now he's run a sub 44. And then you can start discussing why. But the point is that you've got a very precise metric that allows you to compare him today to yesterday to last season to 2 years ago and so on. In cycling, we have nothing like it. And so the only thing we've got to judge these incredible performances is the gaps between people on the day. There's no longitudinal context. So Pogacar, when he won that Tour de France on that last time trial, maybe there he was at 6.2 watts a kilo for the last 30 minutes. Maybe yesterday he was at 6.1. Okay, he's not as good as he was. Had he been at 6.2, 6.3, the gap would have been smaller. Then we can start to understand it. But everyone, Dumoulin, I listened to a podcast yesterday saying, oh, people are getting too hung up on the watts per kilogram. The reason they're getting hung up on the watts per kilogram is because they have to guess. Nobody knows what they actually did.
Yeah. It seems like a simple way to solve the suspicion and to solve the problem. But yeah, you're right. I mean, for most of us.
Just breaking news in that context. Mm. And this is not a spoiler because it's not like we're live. Is that our mate Wilco has just messaged to say Pogacar's been cracked on the final climb of today's stage.
There you go.
So by the time people listen to this, he's now, in fact, I'm looking at this live. The yellow jersey is now 30 seconds ahead of Pogacar's group, and that's with 6Ks to go on that final climb. So everything we've just said probably now needs to be interpreted in the context of Pogacar might actually be regressing in this Tour de France.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's why I've spoken so often about this. Don't pixelate one performance. Don't take one pixel of a picture and say, oh, now I understand this. You step back and look at the totality of performances. And I think what's happening right now in the Tour, and listeners will only get this a day or whatever afterwards, whenever you happen to listen to this, what you're seeing today might be giving you some additional insight into what you saw yesterday.
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating the last couple of days. And depending on when you listen to this, I think it's always important to look at some of the context around outrageously good performances, as we saw in that time trial, independent of what the final result is on Sunday. And certainly looks like Vingegaard is going to be the person to beat, if not the champion, on Sunday. Thanks very much. Yes, Ross.
One last thing, and I meant to bring it up earlier, and I apologize, I wasn't concentrating, is I posted a tweet yesterday after watching it saying, because you know what like frustrates me? I used to do all these power estimates and so on in the Tour de France. And eventually I gave up. I almost lost a bit of interest because you don't know what it means when you get it. Like, so, and we spoke earlier, conservatively between 7.2 and 7.6 watts a kilo for 13 minutes. So what? Okay. VO2 max of 97. And by the way, I'll put all these articles in the show notes as well. The thing about it, though, is that everyone says, okay, we don't trust this. They must be doing something. But what are they doing? Yes. And I don't know what they could be doing to explain what we see, because it can't be something like cortisone, because that's so easily testable. Unless there's a cover-up where you're taking it and not getting tested and you know that you're bulletproof, you know, you're immune to testing. It can't be something like an amphetamine for the same reason. Blood doping, where you can infuse some blood on a rest day, I don't think you can do enough of it to make the differences in performance that we saw yesterday. So people often say, well, what is it that they're actually doing? Like, what explain what it is specifically to cause a 0.05% gap to grow to a 5% gap in one day? I've got no idea. Hmm. Is it a new drug that blocks pain? Because that could do it. Is it a new drug that completely like amplifies the central nervous system drive to cause, but without the other concept? I don't know. You know, and that's why nobody is able to offer a plausible doping explanation. Yes, we've got plausible doping explanations for how they go away and they train for 3-4 weeks at a time. And you take a bit of cortisone to cut the fat. You're on a little bit of blood doping. You're on EPO, maybe some recovery medicines to recover better and to get those training blocks in. But in race, to cause those shifts, I don't know what doping causes that. And that's what really like annoys me about all this is I've got no plausible hypothesis to explain what I don't believe.
Yeah, it's that uncomfortable feeling that you can't explain, which is always the test. I think if you're a fan of sports and you see performances like that in any sport, really, where something just seems out of the norm, it always just makes you feel slightly uncomfortable. And I think that's kind of where we're at the moment with that performance. But anyway, I suppose time will tell, hopefully. Hopefully he'll be exonerated and we will be able to believe the performances. I hope that is true as a fan of cycling. And more importantly, I hope that we still have the competition that we've had over those first couple of weeks, and Pogačar potentially over the next couple of days can somehow come back. Although after today's stage, it doesn't look like that's going to happen either. Professor Ross Tucker, thank you much for your time. I know you're back in South Africa, back in Cape Town next week, but enjoy your time in Boulder. And from us for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.